You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day. And, you know, even for September, it's sunny.
It feels like summer right now, even though fall officially began, I believe, 3 days ago, something like that. We don't get into fall here in the Sacramento Valley quite as quickly as the calendar would suggest. It was in the 90s yesterday. Today, Lois and I are preparing this show on September 25th, 2024, for broadcast on September 26th, 2024. And many parts of the country, if my Facebook feed is any indication, are beginning to feel more like fall. Well, we're going to be 82 degrees today, which is pretty balmy, and 53 degrees tonight. Thursday, the day of the broadcast, 88 degrees. Thursday night, 55 degrees. Friday, 94 degrees and sunny. It's sunny throughout. There's not even a cloud in any of the little National Weather Service icons on their page here. 94 degrees on Friday, 57 degrees Friday night, 92 degrees on Saturday and sunny, mostly clear Saturday night and 55. Sunday is also going to be 90 degrees and sunny. Sunday night, 57. Monday, 93. Just for the record, our average high at this time of year would typically be about 84 degrees. So we're running about 10 degrees above average by next week. Monday will be 93 and Tuesday will be 94. People keep referring to this at my shop as a heat wave. It's above average. To me, a heat wave is a lot higher than this and a lot more miserable. But sure, you can call this a heat wave if you want when we're running 6 to 10 degrees above average for the next week. Let's see what the Weather Service is saying about wind and all that kind of thing. So the extended discussion, Sunday through Wednesday, we will have high temperatures forecast to be slightly above normal with moderate heat risk into Tuesday and then near normal, normal being mid-80s to upper 80s. Locally, gusty north to east wind at times Sunday into Tuesday. And of course, when we hear north wind, we know that's dry, low humidity. So for those of you who have been seeding things directly in the garden or maybe throwing some grass seed out on your lawn or scattering wildflower seeds, water each morning. And if the north wind is blowing, water again midday. I think that's the main thing I wanted to get across with this discussion of the weather. Very mild weather for the next week or so, above average daytime highs. It's cooling off really rapidly. The reason I sort of laugh when someone talks about a heat wave, you know, the breeze was already coming in at sunset, which is 7 o'clock or something like that, cooling off very quickly in the evening. So even though it's above average, people keep asking, I'm buying these broccoli plants, I'm buying these lettuce plants, should I hold them until it gets cooler? No. Get them in the ground and keep them watered. If the north wind blows, check that watering in the morning before you leave for the day. And again, as soon as you get home, because they could dry out very quickly. But the high temperatures themselves are not a concern, really, with these cool season vegetables. I understand the concern because we call them cool season vegetables. The seedlings are fine. Get them in the ground, keep them watered, and they'll certainly be daily. But it's not that high above average. And the only real concern I have looking at this extended forecast is that spell of wind. Dry winds are a really common phenomenon for us here late September into mid-November, just as you folks in Southern California experience the Santa Ana winds predominantly September, October. I understand that season over the last decade or so has stretched into November and December, but those north winds, it's not the temperature, it's the very, very low humidity that's associated with it. So it's just more a matter of keeping them watered. A young broccoli plant will be just fine in the ground. And the reason This is a minor digression, but the reason I really want to make this point, I'd much rather have those plants in the ground than staying in the little tiny pot you bought them in. Any vegetable plant, any flower plant, the more root bound it gets, the more it'll struggle with that transplant process, the slower it will be to get going. So if there's going to be any delay in getting your broccoli, your cauliflower, things like that in the ground, I would strongly suggest you do what I also recommend in the spring for the summer vegetables. Shift it quickly. I have a table set up near my little backyard greenhouse, and it's just set up year round at this point. And it's just a little table with a bag of good potting soil and a bunch of pots nearby. And when a six pack comes home of any vegetable or anything like that, if I don't think I'm going to get it in the ground within a couple days, I just quickly transplant them. I move them up to used four inch or quart size pots or even gallon containers if I think it's going to be a while. But the main thing is to get them to the next size up in a nice rich soil, water them in. You'd be amazed how quickly they take into that new soil and really start growing. And within 10 to 14 days, they're fully rooted to the bottom and ready to go in the ground and can go in the ground sooner. Big advantage of this technique that I've developed over the last few years, that potting soil, if you buy the good stuff, that can be all the fertilizer the plant needs for the whole season. You buy one of these enriched potting soils and shift from the little six pack into that 4 inch or quart pot in the fancy soil that you paid a little extra for. That's the fertilizer that the young plant gets. And that's all I give them. That's all I gave my tomatoes and peppers this season, and they're doing great. So that quick transplant, if there's going to be any delay on getting it in the ground, can actually make a really big difference on how well the plant's established and how well they do. That's the weather forecast with a little bit of horticulture thrown in there. You're listening to KDRT, which is community radio right
but
here
Don,
at 5.7 FM on KDRT. So it's a public radio station. That means we rely on your contributions to stay on the air. If you like what you hear, head on over to kdrt.org and click on the support button. You had a question.
No, I didn't. I had an excitement. My excitement is, do you know that it was 20 years ago yesterday that this radio station started 20 years ago?
20 years of KDRT locally. And if you like KDRT, that support button is really helpful. But also, we're going to be having a big party.
Yes, we are. We're going to go over to Sudwerk Brewing, and we're going to celebrate our 20th anniversary. Live music will be offered by Cowboys After Dark and Max and Julian from the Big Poppies. It's all happening at the Sudworks Brewing Dock Store and Hop Yard, which is 2001 Second Street in East Davis. And it's on Friday, October 18th, starting at 6 p.m. Y'all are welcome and invited.
I made a mistake. I said the sun sets about 7. The sunset right now is 6:58 p.m. That's about 7. All right.
So, it's about 7. I looked it up when you said that. I'm going, that's a little late. I thought it was getting earlier. And it is getting earlier. It used to set at 7:30. And how quickly is it going to go? What is our earliest sunset? 4:30?
Something like that. Depressing. Yeah. That's all I know.
Well, anyway.
So I'm getting a lot of questions about whether to keep watering the way we've been watering through the summer. You know, do I still need to deep soak trees and things like that? Yes. And the reason for that, I think we talked about this in more detail in a recent show, but I just want to say the soil in late September, early October is at its absolute driest that it can be based on at least natural rainfall. And so I would love for you all to be able to back off on your irrigation based on day length and all that kind of thing. I don't think that the soil moisture is where it needs to be for that. We aren't going to have a rainstorm here typically until late October. And the trees that I'm seeing as I drive around, especially younger trees that were planted within the last 3 to 5 years, are very stressed if they haven't been getting proper irrigation. So yes, continue deep watering the big woody plants, shrubs and trees that are in your yard. Yes, you do want to obviously keep watering your vegetables, your summer vegetables, if they're still going. And for many of us, they are going and producing very well. If they're declining, you know, cucumbers, melons, if you've picked them, they're probably done. Go ahead and pull those out so you don't have to put the water in that area. Maybe use that spot to plant peas or broccoli or something like that. But I'm continuing to deep water the tomato plants because they still have a lot of fruit coming. There's the big question. And people are listening in a lot of different places. So I have to, again, put out the 7 weeks from bloom to pick general rule for tomatoes that was given to me by an organic farmer in the Quépe Valley years ago for her data point for early girl tomato, which is a pretty fast ripening one, 49 days from blossom to pick, 7 weeks. Cherry tomatoes, maybe only as little as 4 to 5 weeks, some of the sauce tomatoes and so forth. It's the end of September. So there's places where you would have tomatoes just setting and you know you don't have time for them to ripen. But here we do pretty much have time for them to ripen because we've got the whole month of October that's rather summer-like. So you have to make some strategic decisions. If you've got 30 tomato plants and 10 of them are still producing fruit, take the other 20 out. The ones that are still producing fruit and flowering and setting, you probably have time for some of those, if not most of those, to ripen here in the Sacramento Valley, interior Southern California, and so forth. A lot of other places, obviously, late September is way too late for them to grow 6 or 7 weeks and ripen on the vine. But we still have time for some of them to continue ripening. If they're green, we definitely have time for it, because if they're green and if they're full size, they're only about 10 to 14 days from ripening. So use some strategic evaluation of your present vegetable garden condition and maybe clear some space for fall and winter vegetables. But I always leave some of the tomatoes just because I'm curious to see how late they'll go. And I can tell you there are certain varieties like Lemon Boy, Champion, any of the Roma types, any of those that are indeterminate, though Roma is determinate, any of the indeterminate sauce types, we can harvest into November. And if they have a tougher skin, like the first two I mentioned, Lemon Boy, Champion, well known for a little stronger skin that holds up against weather, many of us have had the pleasant and amusing experience of picking those tomatoes around Thanksgiving or even in early December. I know there's many places where that wouldn't be possible. So we just happen to have a very warm pattern typically to our fall here all the way through the month of October. So you can still get ripening. What starts to happen is happening right now. Some of them are beginning to spoil as they ripen. And so you're out there picking and there's fruit flies and it gets kind of gross. You have to pick fairly carefully. As we get into the rainier season or night temperatures start dropping below 50, they'll spoil faster than they will ripen. So at that point, you might go out there and look at a plant that has 20 or 30 fruit on it, just turning color, pick them. Bring them in, they'll ripen on the counter. That's something we get to do here in California that I understand is not common in many other parts of the country.
So I wanted to tell you about a wonderful organization called the Center for Land-Based Learning. Now, Center for Land-Based Learning works to educate the next generation of Californians on the importance of sustainable agriculture and watershed conservation, combining hands-on experience with classroom learning. The center's program includes sloughs, habitat restoration, farms, leadership, and the caring of our watersheds. For more information, visit them at landbasedlearning.org. So it's fall. Well, it's close enough to be fall. And what can you plant in the fall? So I looked up Don's little list here. I'm going to read it out. Broad or fava beans. Now, aren't those usually a cover crop, or are they do people eat them?
People do eat them, yes. To me, they're like a giant, uninteresting lima bean, but they're really good for you.
Can you plant lima beans now?
No, lima beans are a summer bean.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. There you go. So in the summer, you got lima beans, and in the winter, you got fava beans. That's your right. All right. Then there is a solaria.
Can you tell I'm not a fan of lima beans?
Oh, I am. I think they're wonderful. Yeah. But most people don't have fresh lima beans and they don't know what they really taste like.
The question was, okay, I've got all the, and he rattled through the broccoli, cauliflower, lettuce, you know, the basics, kale. He said, what else can you plant now that's interesting and that does well in this area planted in the fall? That's what this list is.
Okay. Celeriac. Now, yeah. I know celery. Celery is another thing you can plant. Isn't celeriac just a big celery?
It is. It's grown for the enlarged stem.
Okay. Chicory or Belgian endive. That's the same thing. Corn salad. What? Corn salad? It's
another one of those leafy greens like escarole and radicchio that you'll sometimes find in salads at high-end restaurants. And you wonder, you know, it's a little bitter. Some people like that. Some people don't.
Huh. The whole category. I always thought corn salad was something totally different.
Well, in the Midwest, it may well be.
I mean, you can have
is that like corn with Miracle Whip or something?
No Miracle Whip. It's an oil and vinegar dressing, and corn is one of the primary ingredients. Yeah.
So there's wait. There's an actual thing called corn salad.
Yes. That's why I was confused.
You put it in Jell-O.
No, you put it in a bowl and you dish it up and you eat it.
Okay, well, let's move on. Go ahead.
We should start over. Should we
No, I
start
think we're doing great. What else is there?
Okay. Curly endive, also called escarole.
Yep.
And then Florence fennel.
That's the type of fennel that quickly makes a swollen stem. So fennel is easy to grow. We can go back through this shortly, but Florence fennel is just probably the best known version.
Okay. And then garlic.
Yep.
And kohlrabi.
Yep.
Leeks. Well, that's a kind of an onion. So yeah. You can also plant onions.
Yep.
Mustard greens. Wait a minute. Mustard greens?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mustard is used for greens. And there's actually a bunch of varieties of mustard greens on the market. There's some really pretty ones, by the way. If you're just planting some of these things and you want some ornamentals to go with them, there's a purple leafed mustard green that's quite lovely. And it flowers pretty quickly. Well, the flowers are pretty. And the flowers of all these things being yellow draw beneficial insects. So they're easy to grow. And they're the same kind of thing you'd throw into stir fry as you might with spinach or other leafy greens.
Okay. Pak choy, also known as bok choy,
Pak choy, yeah, there's a bunch of those. Tat soy, there's a bunch of these Chinese vegetables, or I should just more broadly call them Asian vegetables, that are mainly grown for the stem or the leaf and used in stir fry. You've probably seen them in almost any stir fry recipe.
I actually grew bok choy one time. It was very
easy,
interesting.
Very easy to grow, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, parsnips. Those are good. Those are root crops. And turnips, those are also root crops.
Yep.
You don't have radishes on here, do they?
Well, I think he had already mentioned radishes, but certainly you can plant radishes. But I do have radicchio, which is not...
What is radicchio?
Okay, several of these are these leafy greens. Belgian endive is sometimes used this way. Curly endive, we mentioned the mustard greens, we mentioned bok choy, radicchio, the corn salad. These are lettuce-like leaves that are sometimes tossed into salad. Most of them are a little bitter. So not everyone likes these. They're distinctive flavored, and some of them are a little bitter. They're generally very easy to grow. So let's say you're doing this thing I've suggested many times, where you take a half barrel, you fill it with that 3 cubic feet of soil that fills it, maybe a little more than 3 cubic feet, and you just pack it with spinach and Swiss chard and kale and lettuce. These are some things that can go with that because they're grown just for the leaves. So it doesn't matter how crowded the plants are. You're not trying to grow a whole head necessarily, although you can certainly do that with things like endive. So you're just going to be picking leaves off of the lettuce and the this and the that and this, the broccoli rob and so forth. And these would be part of that. And you can, I did this one year just to see how many I could fit in a barrel and still get reasonable results. And in a barrel is about 20 something inches diameter, holds 3 cubic feet roughly of soil. I put in 36 plants of these different things. The ones I've mentioned, spinach, I didn't do fennel in that one. I did corn salad. I did regular lettuce and so forth, and just crowded them in together. So the plants are like 6 inches apart, and they all grew into this one great big mass of vegetation. You know what? That's fine. You go out there with a bowl. You may pick some plants in their entirety, just take the whole head. Others, you're just going to snip leaves off. So these are things to add to your salad, but also some of them stir fry very well, the bok choy and all of that group. And some of them, like leeks and onions, can be in there as long as you're just growing them for the leafy part. It's too crowded for them to develop bulbs properly. They would be outcompeted by the roots of the other plants that are in there. But for bunching onions, it's great. For leeks that you may be using just snipping into things, it works great. So you can do this. It's one of the easiest gardening things you can do in the winter, is to take these leafy greens and try some of these exotic ones that you've never grown before and pack them together. And I used a barrel, but you could use even a smaller container as we get into the rainy season, because the biggest issue with containers in the valley is keeping them watered. You wait till it starts raining, that's not a big problem. I can tell you from experience, one Swiss chard plant will take over the whole thing. So if you happen to really like Swiss chard, fine. Otherwise, I'd probably keep that one out of there. But if you like that kind of leafy green, beets, regular red beets or the other kinds grown primarily for the greens are a good option to mix with some of these. So you can have your own gourmet salad container in your backyard, and all you got to do is water it until the rains begin, and then it kind of takes care of itself. You can harvest at will all the way through March.
I have a letter here from Anne. It's a thank you letter, basically. I appreciate the affirmation on peas and beans. Mm-hmm. What I do is plant peas, whatever I have on hand, in the fall, and they go through the fall into spring. When the peas start waning, I'll plant scarlet runner beans in their place. And the hummers wait eagerly for the runner bean flowers.
We've mentioned scarlet runner beans. They're a fantastic way to cover a fence or just get a quick screen. screen if you want some privacy. And yes, hummingbirds absolutely love them, are all over them. And they get, you know, they'll get a few pest problems, like you'll notice some aphids showing up. And then you notice, in my experience, the last 3 years I've grown them, the aphids just kind of disappear. And a big part of that is the hummingbirds and other things like them that come in and go in and just take those off right away. The peas, we were talking about regular garden peas as well as sweet peas. And that was part of last week's program, that this is the time right now to get those planted and how to do it.
So a little off topic, but let's talk about bed straw. I have a bed straw problem.
We all do. And everyone in Davis
does. We all do these days, yeah. You know, we didn't before. I was talking
with one of my old weed science professors probably 5 years ago about this. I said, you know, when we opened, we never saw bed straw. That just wasn't one of those common weeds. And now it may be native. There's a lot of members of that genus, some of which are native, some of which are non-native. And his comment was, in his years back when he was working in weed science, it was not one of their common weed issues. It wasn't something that they were even really concerned about. And then, yes, about 20 years ago, 15 years ago, we started getting more people having it. I blame the squirrels. My theory is that it came in with the squirrels. It was already here. But what disseminates bed straw, for those of you that don't know this plant, some people call it Velcro plant because every part of the plant sticks to you, and the seeds especially stick to you and your gloves and your pants and your socks and your pet.
Well, and your squirrels.
And what is an animal that's casually moving between yards all the time? Well, that would be the tree squirrels, which are new to Davis since the late 1990s. So at least it correlates with the tree squirrels. Whether they're responsible for it, I don't know for sure. But it has become a big problem, partly because it can germinate all the way through the winter, unlike most weeds, which have a fairly narrow window of germination. Bed straw starts to come up. It's a little colder and wetter. November is when I usually see the first seedlings of it. Most fall and winter germinating weeds come up in a fairly narrow temperature and moisture range, and then they grow slowly through the winter, and then they take off in the spring, but they're not still germinating in the spring. I have seen bed straw germinating as late as February. So as early as November and as late as February, under temperature and moisture conditions that are colder and soggier than is optimal for many other weeds. So I've had the experience on my own farm of mowing to get rid of the grassy weeds in an area. All right, everything's done. That's great. And then realizing there's a whole bunch of bed straw seedlings coming up, and it's the middle of December. Now, what do I do? Monitor them and try to get them before they go to seed is my answer. But be aware that part of this weed's adaptive strategy is the ability to germinate over a much longer period than other types of weeds.
So I am in a residential area. I don't have the expanses of mud that you do on your farm. I was wondering, I was thinking about this. Now I'm not able to lean over and hunker on the ground and crawl around and, you know, pick things up that are small and tiny and on the ground. But I was thinking, what if I got one of those string trimmer things? It's got a long stick so I can stand up, and it's got a whirling string. Wouldn't that work? Because those are pretty fragile when they're little.
Yeah, they're very breakable. And one of the biggest problems of trying to hand pull them is they break off. And so you've only broken off a part of it. A string line trimmer is a great way to go with bed straw, especially once you learn to recognize the seedlings.
Well,
and a lot of people don't. They come in the spring, February, March, when the plant has gone into its reproductive phase, where its leaves are bigger, it's climbing up onto things, beginning to flower. And they don't realize that was a really cute little ground covery plant with tiny leaves. November, December, January, very easy to control at that stage. In fact, of course, one of our Davis Garden Show aphorisms is most weeds can be readily controlled in the 2 to 6 leaf stage. In the case of bed straw, it's even longer than that. They're very easy to control with a string line trimmer like you're describing, or even a hoe. You know, just recognize the seedlings, chop them off December, January, everything's really simple. Even burying them with, I don't know, you might have some extra arborist wood chips handy. Yeah. Wait till they sprout, bury them. That actually works too. Now, some may come up in the arborist wood chips and root down through and have that whole zone to themselves. So watch for that. But you can bury them. You can chop them off. You can use whatever, even those top kill organic weed killers that you see on the market, where they're based on, you know, fatty acids of potassium salts or things like that, will burn them and actually give it pretty good control in that stage, that easy to control seedling stage that nobody recognizes. It looks almost like spurge or something. I mean, it's a fairly small leaf and it's creeping across the ground, and you think, how bad can this be? And
yeah,
then
right.
the days start to get a little bit longer and it warms up a little bit and they go into what I call reproductive phase, where they stretch, run, climb, flower, seed. And at that point, they're all over everything. And you're out there pulling them off of your rose bushes and the seeds are sticking to your gloves. And now you're disseminating them elsewhere in the yard, or the squirrels, of course, are doing so. So try to get them. November, especially December, January into early February, it's actually pretty easy to control once you recognize those seedlings.
Well, let's go to the mailbag. I have a question here from Kay and Bill. Hi, Don and Lois. Some of the leaves this year on my sweet olive and lavender trumpet vine, which are partially intertwined, have mottled leaves. A friend told me it might be due to a virus. What do you think? And sending a picture.
Both of those are broadleaf evergreen plants, meaning that they're evergreens that are not conifers. And this answer applies to camellias and pittosporum and citrus and a bunch of other things. It's almost certainly not a virus. First of all, I can't think of any virus that would simultaneously attack something in the trumpet vine family and the olive family. Those are totally unrelated. And generally, viruses are rather host specific. But more to the point, any of those broadleaf evergreens undergo a process where, as a new growth is coming on, nitrogen is drained from the oldest leaves and mobilized. It's mobile within the plant. Some plant nutrients are very mobile in the plant, others are not. So that determines where you'll see deficiencies of them. In this case, it's mobilizing the nitrogen that it needs for new growth up to where that new growth is occurring. And the older leaves are losing their nitrogen, so there's a term for that, but they're also just shedding their chlorophyll and getting ready to drop. And they don't do so in a uniformly yellowing manner. If they were just sort of gently yellow and then drop, it would look like a normal process. Like your golden pothos, your house plants do the same thing. As the new growth is occurring, old leaves, some of them start to yellow and drop. But in the case of some of these thicker leafed or longer lived, I'm not sure what the term is to use, like the osmanthus, where the leaves hang on for 2-3 years, as most broadleaf evergreens do, they'll have a mottled pattern to it. They'll look like large spots of green surrounded by yellow and so forth. It's not a distinct even yellowing, it's a more mottly yellowing. It's just a nutrient mobilization issue within the plant. It's definitely not, in my opinion, a virus in either of those cases.
And when it is taking the mobile things out, is the chlorophyll just stopping in existence, or is it being moved? Or I guess my real question is, has the process gotten far enough along I should pick off this leaf, or I should leave it until it's totally yellow?
Well, you don't need to be picking leaves. I mean, that would become one of these make-work things that we who are in the garden media business like to make people do. Yeah, go pick all the yellow leaves off your trumpet vine. That seems pretty tedious, doesn't it? They'll just fall on their own. Chlorophyll is a very unstable plant pigment. It's one of the fastest to break down. It's one of the shortest lived pigments within a plant. So if anything changes temperature wise or nutrient wise, it will just disintegrate in that leaf, and that leaf will form an abscission layer usually and fall off. And most commonly, you don't even really notice it. This is part of the perfectly natural cycle of the plant. When we really do notice it distinctly, a very common topic that we have here in the spring shows, as pittosporum and osmanthus and other plants are flushing their new growth. A lot of new growth is occurring. Many of the older leaves will yellow due to this nitrogen mobilization up to the new growth. And we answer this question about citrus, pittosporum in particular. It's on xylosma, but it's not as visible because it's a lighter green to begin with. The plants with dark green leaves, when they get this yellowing, it's real noticeable. A lot of other plants are doing the exact same thing, and you're just not really seeing it, where they're just shedding the oldest leaves as a new growth comes on as a part of an internal physiological process. It's not a disease. It's not a problem. It doesn't even really indicate a lack of a nutrient. It just means the plant is making more efficient use of its nutrients. It can be a reminder. If your citrus is yellowing in March, well, that's a good time to start fertilizing citrus anyway. So oftentimes when someone walks in with this question on citrus, we will say, here's a box of citrus food. Go home and feed your citrus. It didn't necessarily absolutely need it, but it does remind you that the plant is using nitrogen at that time. So it's a good time to apply some. Really nothing to be done about this. There's no sign of stress. Great pictures. No sign of stress on these individual plants. It's a natural phenomenon. Virus tends to be more thoroughly distributed on the plant. It's not just on older leaves. Typically, they follow a different pattern. There's a lot of different viruses, but honestly, I rarely see virus problems on plants. I hear virus diagnosis way more often than I actually see it. So this is a nutrient issue, not a disease issue.
And this is different than the live oaks, where because this holds its leaves for several years, whereas the live oak holds its leaves for 14 months. And so there is a time when the new growth comes out, pushing the old leaves off, and it looks like fall.
In the spring, yes. The common problem with live oaks, one of the reasons that people get a little disconcerted about them as a landscape plant in there, you know, it's over your garden, you have a cork oak or a coast live oak. I hadn't heard that 14 month thing, but I mean, yes, they shed a bunch of leaves as new growth is coming on. Same phenomena.
Okay. Well, Kay and Bill also have a second question. I'm sending a picture of yet another cosmos grown from seed that has sturdy foliage and no flowers. Out of several planted, only one bloomed, and it was right next to this one. I planted them in full sun as soon as the ground wasn't too wet. I didn't fertilize it. I just put some homemade compost around them. I love cosmos. Any idea what went wrong?
They look healthy, so let's not give up. There's still time for them to flower before frost, and they look like they're trying to initiate flowers. My experience with cosmos is they are September, October bloom, or the September, October bloom is the heaviest. So they had a cooler, later start, I think, and you still could get bloom on these. Don't give up. But my experience is that if you're planting summer daisies and you plant cosmos, China asters, and zinnias, the reverse of what I just said is how they'll bloom. Zinnias would be blooming first, then the China asters, and then the cosmos. So it may simply be a reflection of the cooler season we had back in May to early June. I'm not absolutely sure about that, but the plants are healthy, so I wouldn't pull them out. I leave them and see if you get a nice October bloom on them.
All right. And the next question comes from Tanya. Hi, Don and Lewis. We are almost ready to plant the bottle brush, pineapple guava, and grevillea in our neighbor's yard. Now, if listeners, if you recall, if you listen to the show, there was a long series of questions and responses about hiding a fence.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm about ready to plant them in the neighbor's yard, and I would like to make sure that the bottle brush are still okay. I up-potted them in late spring and watered throughout the heat of July, well, except for 3 days when we were I came home to find a lot of dead leaves on the bottle brush, but I hoped for the best and kept on watering them. I removed the dead leaves and the weather cooled a week or so ago. The bushes are fine, but they're now a little leggy, as in not as shrubby as they were before. I've attached photos. Question, can I still plant these, and will they thicken up? Should I trim off the top, buy new plants, and give these to a friend for the back 40? Something else? Okay. So, and then she has lovely pictures.
Yep.
Don, before you weigh in on this, I will say these look like really nice bottle brush. And the fact that there's, 16 inches between one ring of branches and another ring, that doesn't look unusual at all to
me.
We
manage plants. Obviously, every retailer has managed thousands and thousands of plants. And sometimes the plant goes dry and drops a lot of leaves, and we quickly get it watered and new growth pushes out. Some plants, it obviously makes them unsaleable. These are healthy. There's nothing wrong with these plants. It's a good thing you did pot them up to a bigger size. I think that made a difference in getting them through. If bottle brush does go dry in containers, I've had this exact experience at my nursery. A lot of the older leaves will yellow and drop very rapidly, but new growth will almost always come out right away. They will flush more from the base if you allow them to. My inclination, I'm not a fan of pruning, trimming, shaping at the time of planting. I just plant. I plant the plant and I water it correctly, and I see what it does. And in your case, you want to see some stuff flush from the base. Great. That's likely to happen, whether or not you trim the tops back. So I like to leave them as is, let them grow for a season, perhaps late spring, early summer, after you've had a flush of growth next year. You'll have a better idea as to whether you need to head them back or anything like that. I don't think you'll need to. I don't think that's going to be an issue. And the plants look good. You did a good job of getting them through the summer. Because I can tell you, it's a lot easier to keep something alive in the ground than it is to keep it alive in a container. As you found, just going away for 3 days can be all it takes to really stress a plant, but you caught it in time. You kept them watered. I think these are ready to go in the ground. And after one season of growth, March, April, May of growth, I think you'll have a better idea whether you need to do any shaping or training on them. Probably not, is my best guess. They look good. So great pictures. Thank you.
And you can send us pictures next April.
Yeah.
And show us how they're doing. We would love to see that.
Yeah. Callistemon is a great group of plants. They got really overused. Southern Californians are probably scratching their heads as they hear me say this, because they were so overused down there that the lemon bottle brush, the most common one, was just planted everywhere. And it was pruned within an inch of its life by the average maintenance gardener. So they turned into one of those ratty looking things you hardly ever saw bloom, and people got really, sort of fed up with them. I think bottle brush is a great plant when you can allow it to grow as naturally as possible. They typically, the most common one, the lemon bottle brush, Callistemon citrinus, has a somewhat arching, weeping growth habit. Not strongly, there are strongly weeping ones, but this one has a somewhat arching growth habit. I've planted a couple on my farm about 20 years ago and left them entirely unpruned, completely unpruned. And there are each of them, there's three of them about 10 by 10, and they bloom, these great waves of bloom of every 2 to 3 months year round. I have pictures of them blooming in the winter, pictures of them blooming in the summer. I backed off on irrigation on those 10 years ago. I'm barely watering them. About once a month, that whole zone gets a really thorough watering, and that's it. And they're doing absolutely fine with that. So if we could start putting regular old Callistemon and some of the new varieties that have come on the market into low water landscapes, mixing them with California natives or with other Australian plants or other Mediterranean plants, and giving them enough space to develop to their full potential, they can be absolutely beautiful plants. And you'll get this amazing bloom on them, 50, 100, 200, 300 blooms all at once. I should say inflorescences, because each one of those is a cluster of 20 or 30 blooms. It's Hummingbird Alley, where I have these. I have a long row of grevilleas, which are always in bloom, leading down to where these bottle brush are, which are in bloom in these cycles. And you walk down there at dusk, and there are hummingbirds dive bombing you because they're going to the grevilleas and the Callistemons. What's interesting about that? Both of them are from Australia. There are no hummingbirds in Australia, but apparently they have a bird in Australia. And I'd like to see a picture of these birds that is attracted to the same kind of flower that hummingbirds are attracted to, some sort of a nectar-feeding bird. So you bring these plants to California, grevilleas, huge group of plants, Callistemon, a bunch of different species and new cultivars, and they're extremely attractive to hummingbirds, and they're all very, very drought-tolerant plants. And all of them, grevilleas and bottle brush, look best if you leave them as unpruned as possible. So give them enough space. Look up the space that this will take up, and don't plant Callistemons right next to the sidewalk where someone's going to have to side prune them. Now, in this particular case, she's looking for privacy and screening. If you can go 4 to 5 feet in from the fence, if it's possible, then you would never have to get in and prune them at all. They'd be allowed to develop to their full potential. If they have to be within 2 to 3 feet of the fence, you're going to do something a little different than what I described. You're probably going to train them up and have them be more like a tree, which you can do. Commercial growers will actually do this. We can bring in bottle brush trained like a tree, and they'll make about a 12-foot screen for that two-story house that bothers you behind you. They can be used for that purpose, but left to their own devices, regular bottle brush is an 8 to 10-foot plant with equal spread. In fact, if you want to see a giant one, the UC Davis Arboretum, go to the Australian Garden. I think it's the Australia New Zealand Garden or something like that is the official term. There's a bottle brush that is still there, that was there in the late 1970s when I would walk way down to that end of the Arboretum, and that was it. There wasn't much else down there. There were some eucalyptus trees and this one big old bottle brush. There's a Banksia nearby if you're interested in that group of plants. That one is way bigger than what I just described. It's also, would that be 60 years old, I believe, at this point? So it's been around a while. And there are dwarf bottle brushes and narrow bottle brushes and so forth. So it's a great group of plants that gets overlooked because it was overused.
All right. Here's a question from Tanya. Thank you for covering sweet peas in your last episode. I was wondering what I could plant in the spring, since you recommended the scarlet running beans for the wooden trellis separating our yards. I will plant sweet peas for the spring. The runner beans did really well, but eventually became infested with black aphids. They still look great as long as you don't get too close. I'm considering that a win. Thank you for your advice. I sincerely look forward to your podcast every week.
Thank you. So the thing about sweet peas is we are talking about planting them now, but you can also plant them in February and in when you do, and that goes for your garden peas as well. The second window of planting typically is February to maybe the 1st of March. And in that instance, you're racing against time here in the valley of the heat. If you plant them in February and we get hot in May, well, okay, you won't get that much bloom, but you'll at least get one nice big surge of bloom. Whereas now we're planting to get them going through the winter and they would start blooming earlier. So two windows for planting both garden peas and sweet peas, September into October, and again, late February, maybe first week of March.
Okay, and oh, we have so many questions today. Anne writes, and this is Anne from San Rafael, who's written before. I always appreciate your wise advice to me and everyone else who writes to you, so thank you. I have a new problem in my vegetable garden. I have seen rats on our critter camera. They have bitten chunks out of 40 or 50 of my early girl tomatoes. Clearly, they think they are superior tasty. My husband set out 8 traps baited with peanut butter. In 2 weeks, we have caught only one rat, even though we have followed directions implicitly and have not touched the traps with our bare flesh. There is no way I'm going to use poison for all the usual reasons. I don't own a gun. And so I can't go out at night and shoot them. And the same goes for basement rats.
Baseball bats.
Clearly, there's a large family of rats out there because I picked up all the damaged tomatoes that were at breaking stage or riper and threw out all the tomatoes that had the rats had bitten in. And then the next day, I came out and there were a dozen more tomatoes that had rat bites. Our rat-catching kitty cat is too old to do much, and much more than sleep next to the front door. Our neighbors bring in their outdoor cats at dusk. So help, what do I do? I would like to have at least a few more ripe, vine-ripened tomatoes before the end of the year. Thank you for your wise and educated help.
Yeah, tree rats
I'm
are
going to
here.
say that, as with all mammal pests, exclusion. Either you exclude the rat from the tomatoes, or you exclude the tomatoes from the rats. So I'm thinking, cover it up.
Barriers are going to be your best bet. Yeah, you have a large population of tree rats or roof rats. We have the same thing here in Davis. And they can, first of all, I can tell you that these particular types of rats, compared to the Norway rats, which are your ground level rats, these are extremely trap shy, even if you wanted to try and trap them. I have, people who have done so will find that you may catch one and that's it on that type of trap. You go buy another type of trap and you catch one, and then they're shy about that. I had a problem in the house at one point with roof rats coming in, and I would set a trap and I knew where the rat was, and I set the trap and they weren't getting caught. So I finally did that little technique of dusting flour around the trap to see what happened to the rat footprints. And they would walk right up to the trap and then make a wide detour around it. I don't know why. I'm not enough of a mammal pest expert to answer why they would walk around it. So typically the pattern is you will catch one and that's it. And that brand of trap, that model, you won't catch anymore. More to the point, this goes in general about the topic of trying to deal with vertebrate pests. You're not going to put a dent in the population. The population is a function of the carrying capacity of your neighborhood, which is based on the food sources available, the habitat, the number of nesting sites, and so forth. You could kill 50 rats, and their adaptive strategy is reproduction, multiple generations, many babies in each generation. So if you caught 10, the next generation will be more than 10. So trying to do a population reduction method with an outdoor vertebrate pest is nearly impossible. Trying to increase the number of higher food chain predators is near, it's fine to do that. Owl boxes and stuff are great, but that won't make any difference either. The carrying capacity is what it is, and you don't know where the nesting sites are. So it would be great if you could find those, and it'd great if you could eliminate them, but that's going to be very challenging. For whatever reason, they're finding your vegetable garden a safe and comfortable place to spend their night and feed. And that's what you want to undo. You want to make it so they don't want to come out to your vegetable garden and be out there at night feeding on those tomatoes. They don't want to be open to the sky because that's where those higher food chain predators would be, the owls in particular, and some night flying other raptors, I guess. But basically, they don't want to be open. Exposed. They want to run across the fence, climb into your tomato vine and move around in there inside the vine, taking a bite out of each tomato. Or in some cases, in the case of tree rats, methodically eating the entire tomato or the entire orange or whatever it is that they've decided they feel safe and comfortable enough to go after. So one thing that has worked for some people is outdoor lighting, because they don't like to be exposed to the light. So if it's not something that would really be obnoxious for your neighbors, but there's some way to increase the lighting out there overnight, at least every so often, that will tend to discourage them, I'm told. And I've seen this actually with other forms of wildlife, that they don't go where there's light as much if they're night pests. So try to get some sort of lighting out there if that's not a totally unreasonable thing to do. But physical barriers are what we usually come down to, especially as the fruit is getting closer to ripening. You might want to go to your local hardware store and get hardware cloth, the weird name for this fine mesh wire material that you can buy. All the regular chains like Tractor Supply and such usually have it. All of the locally owned Ace stores typically have this, and it's malleable. You can shape it. And so in the case of a tomato, you might want to just figure out a way to cover over that part of the tomato cage so they can't easily get at it. If they can't easily get at that tomato, they'll move on to the next thing that they can feed on. Your goal is to move them to your neighbor's yard so they stop feeding on your vegetables and go eat, I don't know, the plums that are still falling on the ground in their backyard. But they want to be covered. They want to be not exposed to the sky. They want to feel safe where they can harbor and spend some time feeding. You know, when I find a pile of peeled kumquats at the base of a kumquat tree, and the only animal that will do that is a tree rat or a roof rat, I know that they felt safe enough to sit inside that dense canopy of that kumquat tree and methodically eat the peel off of 10 kumquats. That's got to take a while, even for a pretty busy little tree rat. So they felt comfortable because they were covered over, they were enclosed. Whatever you can do to trim, if your tomatoes are really overgrown, maybe do some pruning of the sprawling branches that are running from one plant to the other, open it up a little bit. But again, the main thing you'll probably do is cover over the plant if you possibly can in any practical manner. Of course, they can go under and through, and they could even chew through various covers, but they generally don't want to do that if they're exposed. So that's the key. Open things up, a little more light out there, and protect the fruit if you possibly can. Bagging individual fruit doesn't work, because if they feel safe enough to be inside there chewing on a fruit, they'll feel safe enough to tear off the little bag. But if they can't easily get into the protected part of the vine for one reason or another, then that's going to be more effective for you. Something that makes noise, something that moves. I've had people hang old wind chimes on their tomato cage, so the tree rat lands on the tomato cage and suddenly it makes noise, that'll definitely scare them away. Anything like that will probably help, but that's the key, is to make them uncomfortable, make them so they aren't feeling safe enough to sit there and keep feeding on your tomatoes.
One of the things you said was that you had caught them on a critter cam. So if you've got a critter cam, it means that there is a way to know when there is a rat present. I don't know what your technology is like, but if it's possible, you might arrange something so that when something is seen in a particular area, that a light comes on. Now, we have motion detectors on house lights. That's easy. You can set it up maybe so that there's a flash, and that would scare a rat.
The light coming on would actually be sufficient. Coming on rather than staying on might be more effective. Again, I want to emphasize, let's not do something that's really annoying to your neighbors. So right. No big floodlights that are coming on every 10 minutes out in the yard. But, it doesn't require much light. They just don't want to be visible. You know, I've watched them running through my property. And they'll go from the big tree down to the fence over to the cover tree. And they run as fast as they can across the fence line to get to the tree, because that's the part where they're open to the sky. And that's what they don't want. As I've mentioned before, we were talking on a show one time, Fred Hoffman's show, Get Growing with Farmer Fred, and someone wrote in and told us that he was a pest control guy, but he wasn't give his name because he didn't want to get blowback on this topic. And he said he would take carpet stripping, the kind of thing you put on the floor, carpet tacks to hold the carpet in place. And he would run that across the top of the fence just stapling it onto the top of the fence so that they couldn't easily run across the fence right there. You're taking a major runway and probably making it more uncomfortable for them. Not saying they can't get across it, but it's not easy or comfortable. And then he would take flashing, aluminum flashing, and put it around the trunk of a tree facing downward so they couldn't climb up the tree readily. And then he would just figure out something to drape over the tree in the case of a fruit tree. And draping something over a tomato cage wouldn't be that hard to do. And, you know, the simplest thing might be just to start with that. I wouldn't use bird netting because they'll get tangled in it, and that's just a nightmare. But if you did happen to drape over it with frost blanket, sometimes called floating row cover, and gather that around at the base so that it's just harder to get in there, that might help. Again, a really motivated rat will get through almost anything. These guys can get through very tiny holes. They can chew through things if they feel safe enough to spend the time chewing through. But if it's easier to run to your neighbor's yard and drink water out of their pool and eat the cat food they're leaving outside, they'll do that instead. So make their lives more difficult and uncomfortable, and physical barriers are going to be your best bet. But don't hesitate to think about some lighting, because that has worked for some people.
Okay, one last question. Well, not last question, but one more question. The question is, are there any good and reliable resources on what soil structure and components are optimal for indoor houseplants? I see so much these days about chunky mixes made with pine bark being better for houseplant growth and health, but I've always just used normal. Is it okay to say the maker?
Yeah, sure.
Happy Frog potting soil for my houseplants, but I do feel like that's not optimal and doesn't retain too much moisture, or it does maybe retain too much moisture. I would like to be better educated on what is right for houseplants, their growth, and their health. Any resources or information appreciated. Thank you. And Don, who is the top contributor?
Do you know how many different kinds of plants we grow as houseplants? This is the issue we're trying to answer this question. There are ferns. We've talked about ferns.
African violets.
There are trees that are giant trees in their native habitat that we're trying to grow in our own homes. There are gisneriads, which includes African violets and gloxinias and a lot of other really fascinating plants. Many people are trying to grow carnivorous plants as indoor plants, which is not usually optimal for them. And the biggest group, most important group, in my opinion, because they're the easiest, are the aroids. A-R-O-I-D. Aroids. Members of the family Aracee. The most familiar flower in that family is the calla lily. Many of you know the spathiphyllum or peace lily, same structure of flower. But all those philodendrons, all those pothos, all those are aroids. And so having one soil for all your houseplants would be very challenging because they come from different places, different types of habitat. Aroids are generally vine-like things that live way up high in the canopy of a rainforest. Ficus, among the most popular indoor trees, are outdoor plants in full sun where they're native. And so when we tell people that, they think, really, outdoors in full sun? Yes, they're full sun plants. In San Diego, we sold ficus trees to plant in your yard. Not a great plant. The roots are pretty aggressive, but they grew fine in full sun, even in interior San Diego, which is very, very hot. So these are plants that going into your house with 1/8 or 1/10 of the light, it is not going to be optimal, but they're also long-lived woody plants compared to these vine-like things that may not need much of a root zone. So it's challenging to figure out exactly what kind of pot, what size pot, but especially what is the optimal potting soil. For every kind of potting soil that we sell at our nursery, we add, when we're using them, one part pumice to three parts soil. And we do that for better drainage. So everything that we do, we take the regular potting soil or we take our citrus and palm mix or whatever we're using, and we add pumice to it. Perlite is a very similar rock mineral product that enhances drainage, and it's easier to find at a lot of garden centers. So that's fine. We don't happen to prefer it because it kind of floats to the top when you start watering and stuff, whereas the pumice stays in place. These are volcanic rock products, so they have air pockets. So they allow drainage, even as they break down into smaller particles, they're still enhancing the drainage. So that's the first thing, is we always enhance any potting soil with some pumice. For the aroids, those very important members of the philodendron family, we make our own mix. And I'll say this slowly. Two parts orchid bark, one part peat moss. You could probably substitute coir. We haven't tried that yet. One part potting soil. One part pumice or perlite, pumice preferred. So that's two parts bark, one part peat, one part regular potting soil, one part pumice. The bark and the pumice enhance the drainage. The peat helps to retain moisture. So you've got these things that are somewhat in conflict, but there's a reason for that. And then we just use the regular potting soil because it's more economical to do that. That has worked very well for us. Our worst problems with aeroids, which are the most popular houseplant group, is when we take them from the greenhouse grower's soil, which is usually practically straight peat moss, and we put them into a regular old potting soil. Doesn't work. It's too dense, holds too much water, not enough aeration. So we always enhance the aeration for the aeroids. And we found for a lot of other houseplants that works very, very well. In all my years in business, I have never found a commercial brand of potting soil that worked well for all the different types of houseplants. For woody houseplants, let's say you make the mistake of buying a fiddle leaf fig or a Ficus benjamina, we use our citrus planting mix because it's sandier, doesn't break down as quickly as the higher organic materials. And so you can leave it in the same pot longer. You don't have to rush to get it into a bigger pot after a couple of years. Happy Frog is the brand that was mentioned in the question. We sell EB Stone, which is very similar. Fox Farm is out there. That's another one. I will say, really important truism about all these brands and the others that you'll find, you do get what you pay for with potting soil. A really inexpensive potting soil, I'm very concerned wanting to know why it's so inexpensive, because the expensive parts, like the sand for its weight, the peat moss, those things have benefits that you aren't getting probably in a less expensive potting soil. So be cautious about trying to save money on potting soils, and be cautious about buying things called planting mix or planting soil and thinking that they're potting soils. They aren't. They're not intended for container use. So you get a potting soil. I do suggest buying a better quality brand, and almost always get a small bag of pumice or perlite if you prefer to mix into that as well. The big problem most of those mixes have, even the very high quality ones, is they just retain too much moisture. And we know that more people, quote, overwater, end quote, their houseplants than underwater them. And we also know this really important Davis Garden Show aphorism: a plant can recover from drought, it can't recover from rot.
That's a new one, Don. I haven't
heard
so. You say that was an aphorism, but I like it.
Okay, we'll add it to our list. Someday we're going to do a show just of the 50 aphorisms of the Davis Garden Show.
Well, maybe we'll put a list on the website or something. So we're going to close the show with another, it's not an aphorism, it's just a saying. But I've been collecting up these, and this one comes from the Empress of Dirt. I have no idea who that is. They have a blog, and the blog is called Empress of Dirt.
Excellent.
Here we go. I'm a gardener. What's your superpower?
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
We've got some new programming here at KDRT. Check out Grist for the Chill, live Thursday, 10 to 11 a.m., where Dave serves up a truly interesting mix of music with a focus on fingerstyle guitar and percussive groove as it relates to roots, world fusion, jazz, funk, Latin, and Brazilian music, and more. That's Thursdays, 10 to 11 a.m., Grist for the Chill.